From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, telling stories through movies and novels, we talk with John Sayles, who wrote and directed the films Eight Men Out, Mate One, and The Return of the Secaucus Seven. He started off writing novels and short stories, and now he's written a new novel. Also, a talk with the architects who learned from Las Vegas, Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. They're partners in a Philadelphia-based firm. Venturi just won the prestigious Pritzker Architecture Prize for Lifetime Achievement. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new video release of Wagner's Ring Cycle. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about the rerun of I, Claudius on PBS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House is accusing Iraq of diverting emergency food supplies into its regular system of food rationing. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater called it another example of Saddam Hussein's disregard for vulnerable groups of women and children in favor of buttressing his regime. The White House says the World Food Program, administered by the United Nations, which has shipped the food to Iraq, is demanding full restitution from Baghdad and is limiting the distribution of food stock already in Iraq. The Army says a faulty computer program in a Patriot missile battery is to blame for allowing an Iraqi Scud missile to hit a Marine barracks in Saudi Arabia. 28 soldiers were killed in the February attack, the largest single American loss of the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Army said the problem stemmed from an error in the computer software that tracks incoming missiles for the Patriot. In essence, the computer had been overworked after operating continuously for 4 days and nights and began to make imprecise calculations. The Army said a similar problem in another Patriot battery had been detected just days before in another Scud attack in which there were no casualties. Corrective software had been rushed to the battery in Dahran, but it arrived a day after the barracks was struck. At the time of the attack, U.S. military officials said the barracks was hit by debris of a Scud that had broken up in flight and that no Patriot was fired because it was not seen as a threat. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
In a continuing effort to reach Catholics in the Soviet Union, Pope John Paul today said Mass for tens of thousands of Lithuanians who were allowed into neighboring Poland for the service. He later met with top Lithuanian officials in the northeastern Polish city of Wolmza. The Pope told them he supported their sovereignty from the Soviet Union. Gabriel Glazer reports.
The Pope smiled, opened his arms as if to embrace the crowd, and said in Lithuanian that he believed the day is near when he visits that republic. The Pope inspired the Solidarity Movement, which toppled communism here, and Lithuanians said they hope he can do the same for the Soviet Union. The Pope's anti-communist message comes after 2 days of strong attacks on abortion, the country's chief form of birth control. A Warsaw newspaper today aimed unprecedented criticism at the Pope. Yesterday he compared abortion to the Nazi Holocaust, and the paper said the analogy was offensive and inadmissible. The Pope commands great moral authority and affection in Poland, which he is visiting for the first time under democratic rule. For National Public Radio, this is Gabrielle Glaser in Warsaw.
The White House says it's encouraged by the remarks of Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy in Europe today. Levy, who's meeting with representatives of the European community, said that a regional peace conference could take place within weeks. On Wall Street, stocks fell 22.5 points to close at 3,005.36. Declines led advances in active trading of 188 million shares. This is NPR. Mikhail Gorbachev used his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech to ask for more aid from Western countries today. He said that failure by the West to help the Soviets would jeopardize a new peaceful period in history. Today's address, given in Oslo, Norway, was interrupted twice by hecklers who were ejected from the hall. Gorbachev was supposed to give the speech on December 10th, but he put it off because of political and ethnic crises in his country. The Senate Agriculture Committee is considering legislation designed to halt the export of pesticides that federal agencies consider cancer-causing and too dangerous for American consumption. NPR's Caroline Clark reports.
The export of pesticides banned in the U.S. is sometimes referred to as the circle of poison, since foreign-grown foods sprayed with these pesticides can wind up on U.S. dinner tables. Senator Leahy says corporate greed fuels this process.
Chemical company giants ignored their own scientists. They dumped their poisons overseas, and they devastated the lives of completely innocent people.
The committee heard today from several Costa Rican farm workers who became sterile while working with pesticides exported from the U.S. The wife of one of those farm workers urged the committee to consider the impact that these exports can have on people's lives.
We, too, are human beings who feel.
Igual que las personas del primer mundo.
Just like people in the first world.
Leahy says U.S. pesticide companies will have a chance to respond at an upcoming hearing. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The South African government officially scrapped three major legal cornerstones of apartheid today. Two land acts and the Group Areas Act were overturned by the adoption of the new racially based land measures bill. The two land acts had granted white people 87% of the land in South Africa. The official Albanian news agency says a new Albanian prime minister has been named. He is Yeli Bufi, the former food industry minister. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Sayles is one of America's most successful and best-known independent filmmakers. Before writing and directing such movies as The Return of the Sakaka Seven, The Brother from Another Planet, Mate Wan, and Eight Men Out, he wrote novels and short stories. Now Sayles has a new novel called Los Gusanos about Cuban Americans. Los Gusanos means the worms. It's the word Fidel Castro used to describe the Cubans who fled to Miami after he came to power. Sayles also has a new movie coming out later this summer. He says there are some things that you could do in a novel that you can't do in a film.
Certainly scope is one. Los Gusanos goes back in time. It's told through the point of view of maybe 15, 20 characters, and some of those characters we get to know well enough to go back into their personal histories as back as far as the 30s in Cuba. And I think that switching of time periods and that switching of points of view is very difficult to do justice to in a movie. In a movie, you may have three points of view, like an omniscient point of view, and then the guy with the chainsaw and the guy who's running from the guy with the chainsaw. And that's about what an audience can handle in a movie, whereas in a book you can stop, there are chapter breaks, you can pick it up again and you can realize, oh, I'm in this person's head now.
Are there literary or novelistic things that you've tried to do in movies that just didn't work, that made you realize some of the limitations of film?
I think more when I've been writing the screenplay and trying to access more than a couple points of view. Certainly when I was writing Eight Men Out, what I found was that I had about 12 characters, and I wanted to know what was happening with them. And when I tried to get into their personal point of view, it really fragmented the movie more than I wanted it fragmented. So I ended up with telling the story in a fairly omniscient point of view, and then having one or two of the characters who you attached yourself emotionally to more than the others. So you might get more personal scenes with them rather than just the baseball scenes and the more public scenes. But I definitely found that I couldn't actually get into the point of view of the different characters.
You haven't written a book for a while, right?
No, in the last 10, 13 years, I've done maybe three short stories, and that's all the fiction writing I've done, except for, a lot of research on Los Gusanos. But finally, I just sat down and wrote it in about a year.
So why did you want to get back to the form of the novel?
Well, it's a story that I wanted to tell for a long time. I've been going down to the Miami area since the mid-50s when I had relatives who lived down there, and got interested in that community, the development of what at first seemed like a foreign city on American shores, and then just as people began to assimilate, what was the nature of that? What's it like to be an exile as opposed to being an immigrant? And once I start something, I wrote the first couple chapters 13 years ago, the characters kind of demand that you finish the story. That happened with Eight Men Out, which I wrote 11 years before I got to make it. You feel like you've made a deal with those characters to tell their story, and though you may walk away and do different things, they're still there.
Several of the stories that you've written or told in movies have had to do with activism, or with the decision to be active in whether it's labor or politics. Have you ever been an activist of any sort in your life?
Certainly not a leading activist. I've been in marches. One of the difficulties that I was just talking about information is the more you know, the more you feel like you need to know before you jump off and do something. You know, certainly people who go into the armed forces, there's that question of, am I here to think or am I here to follow orders? And once you give yourself up to that, probably the best thing to do is really to just follow orders as best you can and support the people who you're supposed to support. But there's a larger question of, do I really want to be somebody who just leaves the thinking up to everybody else? So a political movement can be like an army. And the minute that you start to really ask questions and say, this is not black and this is not white, it probably means that where you plug into any one movement, is going to be somewhat limited.
If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter, film director, and novelist John Sayles, and he has a new novel, his first in a bunch of years. It's called Los Gusanos. Now, your new novel, Los Gusanos, you did not, from what I've read about this, you did not have an agent. You sent the book yourself to some publishers who you'd singled out as being good possible publishers for it. And then you did the negotiating yourself as well.
Yeah.
I was interested in that because I think most people choose to have an agent for several reasons, one of which has to do with wanting somebody to be a buffer between you and the financial negotiations. I was wondering why you opted to not have an agent, and if that had anything to do with having to do all this work yourself in the film world and being used to it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the book was pretty much what I wanted it to be. I really didn't feel like I wanted to go through a process with a publisher whereby they looked at it and they had their feelings and they had meetings about it and they came back to me and said, you know, these are the changes we're interested in, whatever. I certainly had run it by lots of people who had read it, who kind of in an amorphous way served as my editor, you know, who in the, you know, case of the people who were Cubans who read it, they helped me with the Spanish and with the details of you know, Cuban life that I felt shaking on. Some people just said, you know, I don't understand something. And that's really, when I have worked with an editor on a book, that's really what they've done, is if they just asked me questions. So I felt like the book, in a way, had already been edited as much as I wanted it edited. As far as having an agent as a buffer between me and the financial negotiations, I make enough money making movies that, you know, certainly working on a book for 13 years is not a good economic move. To go back to writing novels, if you've been writing screenplays, you know, even the lowest paid screenwriter, which I was when I first started, you know, I got $10,000 to rewrite Piranha, and my second novel had, you know, gotten me $10,000, and that took a year and a half to write. So the financial thing was not that important to me, to auction it to the highest bidder and create some kind of, you know, feeding frenzy that would bring me more money. And then also, since I wasn't going to be in this kind of relationship as an employee, as somebody who was going to then go back and do some rewrites, I wasn't so worried about the power relationship getting messed up by the fact that I might have said, well, if you can offer more money or if you can offer me, you know, it was as important for me that I wasn't lost in the shuffle, that I wasn't the 10th book on their list for that particular, you know, season of publishing, or that, you know, that they put out at least 50,000 copies in the first run. Those were as important to me as what the advance was. And most of the offers were almost identical, which kind of told me, you know, where my book stood and where publishing stood at the time that I entered it.
My guest is novelist, screenwriter, and director John Sayles. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer and film director John Sayles, and he has a new novel called Los Gusanos. You have a new film that's scheduled to come out soon called City of Hope.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a preview of what the film is like?
It's like a lot of my other movies in that there's a large cast of characters. It's about the kind of melting pot politics that happen in small cities. I think cities in America very often the day-to-day politics are not ideological but practical, and so it really boils down to you know, if your ethnic group is holding sway at that moment, your cousins are going to get jobs, and if it's not, your cousins aren't going to get jobs. You know, where does your particular ethnic group, racial group, family group stand at that time? And so City of Hope is set in a kind of mythical New Jersey city called Hudson City that, you know, the main ethnic groups at the moment are, you know, white Italian Americans, black people, and Hispanic people, and the racial mix is changing.
You live in a Jersey City called Hoboken, which is over the river from New York, but you shot your movie, I think, in Cincinnati?
Yeah.
How come you couldn't shoot it in Jersey?
Well, various reasons, mostly to do with that we had a fairly low budget and that we could just get more on the screen if we shot in Cincinnati. The main practical one is that Cincinnati is a much less condensed city. You know, people don't triple park there. A traffic jam lasts a minute. A traffic jam in Jersey City lasts half a day. It's not in a flight pattern, and so a very practical thing when you're shooting a movie is how many airplanes go overhead per hour. In Cincinnati, it's almost zero. In Jersey City or anywhere in the New York hub, it's dozens, and so you're always waiting or saying, oh, God, we're going to have to fix this in the, you know, the sound mix.
Now, I take it this is an independent production.
Yeah.
But do you have a studio to distribute it?
Yeah, the Samuel Goldwyn Company is distributing it, and it's going to be opening in mid-August in New York City and then a week or so later in most other places.
Now, I know you like to have Final Cut and as much independence as possible in making the movie. So when you entered into this deal with Goldwyn, what were your specifications about what they could or couldn't say about the movie?
Actually, Goldwyn picked the movie up after it was done. We showed it at the Sundance Film Festival. The financing came from a pre-sale to home video to RCA Columbia Video. And it was basically, here's the script. You know, we don't know who's going to be in it yet, but, you know, don't count on there being any major stars in it. And here's our track record. And what you see is what you get. And so it really was a deal where Final Cut was implicit in the contract.
What do the studios consider to be your biggest success?
I think the only things that are on the radar are studio movies, so probably Eight Men Out, which still hasn't made its money back, but certainly as far as getting attention within that world and having players, actors who they consider, oh, these are people who are in our movies as well. Eight Men Out was the most likely to be kind of considered, this is a somewhat Hollywood movie. You know, it was distributed by Orion, which is a real Hollywood studio. Financially, I don't think anything of ours has made enough money to even show up on the meter. all my movies together, I've directed 7 movies now, combined haven't cost $20 million, and that's, the average Hollywood movie is creeping toward $20 million for production costs.
I read somewhere that you've been acting in Italian and Japanese movies to make some extra money.
Not to make any money. For the fun of it. Certainly, it's always instructive to me and fun to work in other people's movies as an actor. And how can you turn down a working vacation to Okinawa or to Milan? And I happened to have some time off. It was when I was actually writing the novel. I happened to have some time off from movie making. Where I had to be at a certain place at a certain time and got to go over and see how other film crews work, see how other directors work. And it always, I think, helps me to work as an actor and then think about, okay, what was very helpful to me on the set,
what's something that you learned from working in a Japanese or Italian movie?
I think in general, it's more the experience of just working as an actor in a movie. When you're sitting around the set and trying to stay in character, what would help you stay in character? What information about the flow of the day, when are we going to get to your scene, would help me? you know, when can I get on the set? You know, what information, when you finally do get to shoot, is going to help you as far as the coverage? You know, it's one thing as an actor to, you know, kind of take care of yourself, and it's another thing when the director can really give you an idea, okay, we're only going to do this from two different angles. So you can really blow yourself out emotionally in this first angle because this is the close-up angle. And then we're going to do kind of a wide shot that's going to be an establishing shot. And so if you've already kind of, you know, blown yourself out emotionally and you don't really have much left, that doesn't matter because we're only going to use the first three lines anyway. Whereas if you don't have that information, you're always kind of holding a little back and you may walk away from the set feeling like, geez, I could have done better. And as a director, what I really want my actors to feel at the end of the day is that they got to do their best stuff. They got to give it their best shot. And always as an actor, I'm picking up ways to be a better director.
So you don't get offers from American movies to act?
Oh, now and then, very small things. I've been in some independent features, but usually I'm busy. And right. Most, you know, big studio movies, even if the casting director or the director is interested in me working, it's like a five-week commitment. So the lower budget movies, which the whole movie is only 5 weeks, so if you're playing a small part, you're only going to be there 2 days, are more likely to, you know, coincide with my schedule.
Let me talk to you a little bit about TV. The series that you started, Shannon's Deal, unfortunately did not get renewed for another series. What was the grand scheme in your mind when you started it? What were you hoping it would be, and how close did you feel you were able to get it? I know you pulled out of the series, but I'm sure you were still emotionally involved with it on some level.
Yeah, well, the grand scheme was the interest in working on a character for a period of time. I mean, one of the things that you can't really do in a movie is go into more than one character in a lot of depth. It's a great chance for actors to work in some kind of depth, and it's very rarely used for that. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is provide a couple of the actors, a couple of the characters, this time, this bunch of episodes where we could see different aspects of their character. In fact, their character could develop rather than being a cop show or something like that where you really, the person is going to be the same every week, and it's just, you know, the villains who change. And I've seen, you know, other TV shows have done that. Certainly Hill Street Blues did a good job of taking characters and taking them a ways down the road emotionally with their personal story.
I was just wondering if the experience on the whole was good enough for you to ever want to try TV again.
Sure. I mean, my main feeling was I want the shows to be good, and I felt like the shows ended up being good. And I was never in it for the long run of saying I want this to last forever, even though the shows may fall off in quality. So I felt like I was able to do good work there, and that's really what I cared about the most.
Well, John Sayles, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Filmmaker, writer, and novelist John Sayles. He has a new novel, his first in over 10 years. It's called Los Gusanos. Beginning this Sunday, the PBS anthology program Masterpiece Theater is marking its 20th anniversary by rebroadcasting one of its most popular miniseries, I, Claudius. It was first run in this country in 1977. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
I'd only been a TV critic for a couple of years when I, Claudius premiered on PBS, and it taught me a terrific lesson. This was back when miniseries were relatively new. It was the same year that ABC struck gold with Roots. And the normal operating procedure for most PBS stations was to screen only the first hour of a multi-episode drama for critics. This was back in the dark ages, remember, before VCRs. And previewing a new show meant sitting in a screening room and having the videotape fed in from a local TV station's control room. So anyway, I watched the first hour of I, Claudius, and it was no big deal. A few good scenes, yeah, but it was pretty cheap-looking. I caught a boom microphone on camera once, and I wasn't too impressed. I wrote a so-so review, and that was that. Except that I kept watching I, Claudius each week on TV, and it kept getting better and better. By the middle of the series, I had written a retraction of my earlier review. By the end, I was calling Derek Jacobi's Claudius the best performance of the season. Since then, I've always demanded to see every miniseries in its entirety, which, when you're dealing with Danielle Steele, can be pretty brutal, but that's the price you pay. The point is, seek out I, Claudius, and stay with it, because this Roman history lesson keeps kicking into a higher gear. I know, because I've just watched the whole series again. It's not until episode 9, for example, that John Hurt really cuts loose as Caligula. He stuns his royal court by performing a dance dressed as Jove, in an outfit more suited to a drag queen than a Roman emperor. His stuttering Uncle Claudius offers his opinion with words that are very carefully chosen.
Oh, George! Never have I witnessed a dance that gave me such profound spiritual joy.
Did you like it?
It was indescribable.
Well, it was only a rehearsal.
Oh, whatever will the finished performance be like?
It's even later in the show when Claudius, who's spent his whole life as the court buffoon, informs the skeptical Senate that he's about to take the throne, a speech that Jacobi performs magnificently.
It is true I'm hard of hearing, but you will find it's not for want of listening. As for speaking, again, it's true I have an impediment. But isn't what a man says more important than how long he takes to say it? It's true, again, I have little experience of government. But then have you more? I at least have lived with the imperial family who have ruled this empire ever since you so spinelessly handed it over to us. As for being half-witted, well, what can I say? Except that I have survived to middle age with half my wits, while thousands have died with all of theirs intact. Evidently, quality of wits is more important than quantity.
I, Claudius got away with a lot because of its historical trappings. It's wilder and kinkier than any primetime soap opera. In fact, the producer of Dynasty told me once that she created that show as a modern-day I, Claudius, but she didn't even come close. Dynasty never had a copulation contest, or incest, or ritual murders. Or a cast like Derek Jacobi, John Hurt, Sean Phillips, and Patrick Stewart, who's now starring as Captain Picard in Star Trek The Next Generation. I, Claudius is still one of the best things Masterpiece Theater has ever offered. I, David, recommend that you watch it. All of it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The creed of modern architecture was less is more. Architect Robert Venturi's response was, less is a bore. Venturi was just honored with architecture's most prestigious award, the Pritzker Prize. Coming up, we talk with Venturi and his partner Denise Scott Brown about the new directions that took contemporary architecture. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about his favorite version of Wagner's Ring Cycle, a 10-year-old German telecast that's just come out on video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House has confirmed that President Bush has dropped his opposition to inviting Soviet leader Gorbachev to the London Economic Summit next month. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
Gorbachev will get his chance to make a personal appeal for massive Western economic assistance when the world's industrial democracies meet in July. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the president told British Prime Minister John Major that he had no objection to Gorbachev's attendance. However, U.S. officials say Mr. Bush advised Major to select a venue outside of the formal summit agenda for Gorbachev's appearance. The administration had been reluctant to see Gorbachev in London. It feared that Gorbachev's appearance would distract from other matters the summiteers will take up and might increase the pressure on the Allies to provide more aid for the Soviet Union than they are already willing to give. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
For a third day, Israeli warplanes have struck at guerrilla bases in southern Lebanon. Police say that more than 20 people have been killed in the raids and more than 80 others were wounded. Lebanese police said that artillery clashes following those airstrikes and interfered with rescue efforts. The raids are seen by the government of Lebanon as a threat to peace efforts and a challenge to a cooperation treaty signed this week by Lebanon and Syria. 6 weeks of deadlock in talks on the future of Northern Ireland have ended after a meeting today in Belfast. The four main political parties said that they will begin face-to-face inter-party talks on the 17th of June. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
It should be the first time that inter-party talks will have taken place in almost 16 years, although Sinn Féin will be excluded because of their links with the outlawed Irish Republican Army. The main stumbling block had been the identity of an independent chairman for the second round of talks set to involve the government of the Irish Republic. The parties have been unwilling to proceed with the first round inter-party talks until the issue of the chairman is resolved. This is yet to happen, but the parties today said they're confident that agreement on this can be reached before they proceed with the first round on the 17th of June. Britain's Northern Ireland Secretary Peter Brook welcomed the news and said he would spend the next week looking for a suitable chairman. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
And a volcano in southwestern Japan continues to send lava into the air, along with rocks landing as far as 5 miles away. At least 38 people have been killed. Police have closed off two main roads leading to a town with a population of some 44,000 people. A government official says a special fund will be set up to aid some 6,000 people evacuated from the slopes of the mountain. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 22 points to close at 3,005.36 on volume of some 188 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. According to the White House, the UN has frozen shipments of food into Iraq and is now limiting distribution there. The reason, according to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, is that officials in Iraq have diverted some of the UN food shipments to the hometown of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. The food is intended for Kurdish refugees. The man who videotaped the police beating of Los Angeles motorist Rodney King is now demanding payment for the tape from the hundreds of television stations across the country that have broadcast it, and he has threatened a $100 million lawsuit against stations that won't pay. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Calling the tape of the Rodney King beating the most important video of the 20th century, the lawyer for George Holliday said he is demanding $7,500 from each of the 900 stations that have broadcast it and an additional $2,500 if they want to use it again in the next 5 years. George Holliday, who manages a plumbing business, recorded the King beating from the balcony of his apartment when he was trying out a new minicam. He brought the tape to Los Angeles TV station KTLA, which paid him $500 for it, aired it during its copyrighted newscast, and made it available to CNN and other news outlets. But Holliday contends that the $500 was not an outright sale and that he still holds the copyright. KTLA News Director Warren Cherugino disagrees. "We gave him a check," said Cherugino, "and he cashed it." I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
In Pakistan, officials say that three Chinese engineers kidnapped last month by bandits have been let go. However, authorities denied that ransom demands had been met or that a prison inmate would be set free. The engineers were kidnapped while working on a government project. There have been two other kidnapping incidents involving foreign nationals in the same area this year. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last month, Robert Venturi won architecture's most prestigious award, the Pritzker Prize. When Venturi started working, the dictum of modern architecture was, "less is more." In response, Venturi said, "less is a bore." He argued for messy vitality, for complexity and contradiction, and for decoration, which was anathema to many modernists building steel and glass boxes. My guests are Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. They're partners in a Philadelphia-based firm. They're also married. Venturi, Scott Brown, and Associates designed the new wing of the National Gallery in London, which will open this summer, and they're working on a new performance hall for the Philadelphia Orchestra. Venturi and Scott Brown have collaborated on buildings as well as writings, including the now classic book Learning from Las Vegas. The Pritzker jury citation said that the pair changed the course of architecture in this century, allowing architects and consumers the freedom to accept inconsistencies in form and pattern and to enjoy popular taste. Venturi has been credited with saving modern architecture from itself. I asked what he wanted to save it from.
Some people considered me very radical and considered that my stance was anti-modern architecture in a very simple way. I think my stand was not that. I consider myself still a modern architect, and I was criticizing modern architecture as it had become, which was a very kind of, it had developed into a rigid ideology. The young students who were studying it were almost like seminarians rather than students. They were getting the word, and the implication was that there was opportunity to go beyond and to see modern architecture in the context of history and as an appropriate mode for the time.
And the word was what? The ideology was what?
The ideology was many things, but the in aesthetic terms, it was simplicity, consistency, minimalism, strict rigidity, not the acceptance of contradiction, all of those things that made in the end not for sort of beautiful purity but kind of dead purity.
You came up with the phrase messy vitality to describe what you were after.
Yes.
And what did you mean by that?
Well, I think there was a lot of what I wrote about, and Denise Scott Brown influenced me here very much, was the manifestation of modernism in the urban landscape. And I think people were beginning to realize, other people were at the time, that a lot of places where modernism had won out, especially in urban renewal, the results were dead. People didn't like living in them. They were a kind of imposition of one elitist culture that by now was dead on into a situation where we really are and were then into many different cultures that had to be acknowledged in our time. This is no longer the time for a universal idealistic pure and elitist art, if you will.
One of the buildings that you're working on now is for your hometown of Philadelphia. Well, it's the town you're in now.
Right. It is my hometown.
Yeah, okay, because sometimes that means you're originally from there. Okay, so it's basically a new home for the Philadelphia Orchestra that you're designing. Give me a sense of what you're thinking about with this building.
For the building itself and for the orchestra, we had to think very hard of the fact that people could listen to the Philadelphia Orchestra on CDs in their home. And the building needs to help structure a festival, a festive situation, a gala occasion, which makes you want to come to Philadelphia and be in this building and be part of a group who are sharing the music. And the architecture of the building is designed to help produce that gala occasion in how you enter it, how you go to your seat, and when you sit in your seat and the enthralling moment of the beginning of the concert happens, you are aware of all the people sharing it with you as well as the orchestra sharing it with you. You feel as if you're in a room and you can feel that electricity that you can't feel at home. This is what the building must help the orchestra to do.
One of the things, to get back a little to what Denise was saying, is I think one of the most wonderful things that the Philadelphia Orchestra did was to decide to locate this building downtown. In the last 50 years, practically any concert hall that you can think of in the United States has been built at the edge of town to make it convenient for the suburbanites, where the land is relatively cheap, and also to make parking, to accommodate parking. And it was very courageous and very appropriate, and Philadelphians ought to be grateful for this, that they said, no, we're going to put it downtown, and we're going to truly derive the benefits for ourselves being downtown, but we're also going to contribute in the ways that Denise said.
My guests are architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about architecture with Denise Scott Brown and Robert Venturi. Let me ask you, you're an example of a couple who are your partners in the business. You work on ideas together. You write things together. You're also married. I think it's often true that when people really are very close to each other, they're kind of sharing ideas all the time, and it's sometimes hard to tell where one person's idea ends and the others begin. So how do you go about working together and then deciding whose byline goes on it or whose name goes on it? Who gets the primary credit?
We ourselves don't have a problem. We have a system. But my problem is with the rest of the world. I'm just have very great trouble being recognized at all, as you will notice from the recent Pritzker Prize. And in the area of architectural design, there are so many immeasurables and insecurities and ambitions and emotions of all sorts that truth goes out the window. Critics make of that situation what they personally need to make. And so we can complain all well as much as we like, but we will not. The attributions and the credits and the honors will go as is needed by the society, not as actually it ought to be.
Are you saying that you think it's that there's sexism behind it, that because you're the woman on the team that you're less likely to get acknowledged?
Part of it is sexism. Part of it is the fact that we're dealing with areas that are enormously important to architects, where they sink or swim by whether they're good designers. And yet you can't teach a person really how to be a good designer, and you can't measure whether they are on any measurable scale. And yet architectural success depends on that very unmeasurable element. Therefore, architects need to create gurus. And the gurus help them tread these very difficult areas in the field and very important areas. And the gurus, because most architects are men, the gurus are men. And how that will change with time, I'm not quite sure.
Reverend Ventura, do you share this point of view?
Very, very much so. And I think it's interesting, too, that it's somewhat generational. I think if we were a younger generation, it would be much easier for us to be accepted as true partners and for Denise to be truly an architect and planner. And I think it can happen that your situation even when the situation changes and the newer generation is accepted, the older situation stays on. It's a funny phenomenon. You'd think that older women, if I may refer to you as an older woman, our older generation, would get some of the benefit from the more enlightened view of today, but somehow it doesn't rub off. And it is a sad situation.
Do you feel in any ways that your work or your theories have been misunderstood or boiled down into certain cliches that don't really apply?
Many, many ironies, because to some people we are elitist, and we are pretty darn educated for architects. I mean, we probably have, for my generation, I have a knowledge of history probably that very few architects at least then had, and I think have now. On the other hand, we're known as those Las Vegas architects, and then to other people, we are two historicists. So we get it from all directions and so forth. I think it's inevitable that that you're going to be misunderstood. Everybody's been misunderstood. And so it's inevitable that your ideas are going to be somewhat corrupted and you're going to shudder. But it is frustrating to see kind of parodies of what you're thinking and doing. But that's life. And I think if you're doing something subtle and complex, that's inevitable.
Has anybody really expected you to ever do something that you didn't want to do because of the cliches about you?
It is sad in a way for us that we have not been able to do commercial architecture. We would like to do commercial architecture. We have done, on the other hand, we're very happy to be architects. We've got a lot of opportunity in institutional architecture, which is also fascinating.
When you say commercial architecture, do you mean like a fast food building or a corporate headquarters?
A corporate headquarters and also maybe a hotel on a strip or something like that would mm-hmm. be very interesting to us.
Why would you like to do it, and why aren't you getting offers like that?
I guess we are thought of as too intellectual and highfalutin and so forth. The irony is that the buildings we do are much more difficult and complex. There's nothing more complex in a way than a museum, perhaps much more complex than an office building, which is highly repetitive for many stories up. But if you have a reputation for being a highfalutin institutional architect, it's hard to get that other kind of work, even though we've written about it a lot very sympathetically.
So would you like to do a hotel on a big gaudy strip like Las Vegas?
We'd love
yes.
it.
Yeah? What, tell me some of the things you'd want to put in it if you could do that.
Well, we might make the whole facade a sun, you know, blinking and stuff like that. I don't know. It's hard to know.
Depends where and what the purpose yeah. of the hotel was.
In some ways, I hate to speculate. I rather like to be challenged by the immediate situation. I think we could do something good. But on the other hand, we love doing our institutional work.
We've been in hundreds of hotels, and we love looking at hotels. And we'd analyze quite carefully. There are several ways of being in a hotel. There's this type of hotel with big ballrooms and big conference rooms. There's the type that followed it, which stressed the little series of small lounges. And then there's a third type, and analyze the pros and cons of each for the particular problem.
You know what I really like about good, like, institutional or public architecture? Mm-hmm. They're like the public palaces when it's really built well. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone mm-hmm. can go to them, especially if it's something like a library where there's no admission. I mean, in a concert hall, there yep. is an admission. But it's your chance to be in a really grand, big, fantastic yep. place. Movie yep. theaters used to be like yep. that. They're mm-hmm. not anymore.
I completely agree. It's that kind of thing is what makes a city great, where buildings that have a civic scale, a monumentality in the good sense of that word, and where you as an individual can be awed but also feel at home and not be intimidated and love the richness.
Feel like
of
a
the
citizen.
Effect. Feel like a citizen. That's what a good city should produce.
Any statements you've ever made in print that have been repeated that you really wish you could take back because they've been so misinterpreted or you've changed your mind?
Less is a bore.
Less is a bore. Messy vitality. Main Street is almost all right. No, I generally like them. And since we're not in public life too much, we don't have too many opportunities to make faux pas that are then taken up.
I think less is a bore is terrific. I think that's really catchy. And it does sum up.
Yeah.
I mean, you were reacting against yeah. less is more, which is that minimalist aesthetic that you thought.
The only reason I said less is a bore is because less is more was said by Mies van der Rohe, and Mies van der Rohe was a very wonderful architect and, in his way, very complex.
Oh, so you didn't intend that as a put-down of Van der Rohe, but of just the architects that tried to follow in his footsteps and became boring instead of fresh
and original. It's very complex because we do love modern, the great period of modern architecture, Le Corbusier, Aalto, Wright, and so forth.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. Venturi just won architecture's most prestigious award, the Pritzker Prize. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Noah Adams, National Public Radio in Washington, with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev is asking for aid from the West to help with his economic reform program. There's been a bone marrow transplant from a 14-month-old baby girl who was conceived just for that purpose. We'll discuss the ethical aspects of the practice, including would it be right to abort a fetus that did not work out as a donor. A civil rights bill has passed the House, but with not enough votes to override a presidential veto, and a report on AIDS 10 years after its discovery in the U.S. That and more is coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The four operas that make up Wagner's Ring Cycle form one of the most monumental enterprises in musical history. Last year, PBS telecast the recent Metropolitan Opera productions. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that the very first TV Ring Cycle from Germany was far more impressive. That production, which first aired 10 years ago, has recently been issued by Philips on video. Lord has a review.
Some people can't forgive Richard Wagner for being Hitler's favorite composer. But Wagner's music, composed during the turmoil of the Industrial Revolution, wasn't just celebrating German culture. Perhaps the most controversial production of his Ring Cycle was the one presented at its centennial in 1976. That production was more a moral indictment of 19th century German greed and hypocrisy than a glorification of Germany's mythic past. Wagner's grandson Wolfgang was the director of the theater at Bayreuth, Germany, which was built especially to house Wagner's operas. He invited two Frenchmen, a great conductor, Pierre Boulez, and a young iconoclastic stage director, Patrice Chéreau, to offer their daring reconsideration of Wagner's great four-part, 14-hour musical epic. Like the Mozart operas Peter Sellers directed for PBS, Chéreau offers us deliberately anachronistic images of Wagner's mythical settings. The Rhine becomes a hydroelectric dam. The Rhine maidens are prostitutes. Instead of long robes, Wotan, the king of the gods, wears a 19th century frock coat. His wife, Fricka, wears a glamorous evening gown. In their private chamber swings a huge pendulum. Their days are numbered. Siegfried's funeral pyre, upon which Brunhilde immolates herself at the end of Götterdämmerung, is surrounded by tenements, and the witnesses to the event look like striking workers from the 1920s. There's a sense of both history and timelessness telescoped in this mélange of styles and periods. The modern world is directly implicated in the ancient myth. Above all, the characters seem more human than in traditional productions, more tormented by the inexorable chain of betrayals that propels every action.
Oh,
Musically, Boulez takes a fresh look at the score and strips away all the usual Wagnerian heaviness. The orchestra has the transparency of chamber music. Characters sing with a fluent, conversational intimacy. The narrative moves like the wind, even in the long monologues. There isn't a dead spot in the entire 14 hours. And there are powerful, complex performances by Donald McIntyre as Wotan, Gwyneth Jones as Brunhilde, handsome Peter Hoffman as Siegmund, the young American soprano Janine Altmaier as Sieglinde and Gutruna, and Heinz Zednik as the slippery fire god Loga. Their voices don't have the ringing grandeur of the great Wagnerian singers of the 30s. There's a remarkable historical clip in a documentary that's included in this 7-videotape set, in which you can hear Laritz Melchior and Frieda Leider. But in this fresh, moving view of this work, gorgeous singing may be beside the point. This is Wagner for our time, and it teaches us to see what beauty and heroism exists beside the pain and ugliness in our own troubled world.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Philips video release of Wagner's Ring Cycle. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Vablaitis. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
New York Times reporter Elaine Shalino was writing about the tyranny of Saddam Hussein back in the mid-80s, before most Americans knew who he was. Now she has a new book about Saddam Hussein. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about her experiences as a woman journalist covering hotspots in the Middle East. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.